Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
Welcome all to the 41st episode of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. We're taking a bit of a breather this week and looking back on some of the highlights from our third run of episodes, and I assure you that normal service will be resumed from next week. If you are new to this show, Behind the Lines features a lengthy interview with a sports writer about their career, in which they also discuss their favourite examples of sports writing. If you've only recently signed up, the whole 40 episode archive is available to listen to now. We've also built up a pretty spectacular reading list based off our guests' picks and submissions to date, so I've collated them all on a handy PDF doc with links to the articles wherever that is possible. So if you want to get your hands on it, do get in touch. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at GCooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. We're going to begin our look back now by returning to episode 28, which featured US sports writer Sam Smith. You'll recognise Sam if you watched The Last Dance on Netflix, because it was Sam who wrote the scandalising book, The Jordan Rules, which showed the world a very different version of Michael Jordan than the carefully crafted and well-marketed version that everyone had known to that date. The book caused a pretty major ruckus when it was published, to the point that Sam was advised not to come to work for a few days and ultimately was reported missing by the Associated Press. I began by asking Sam why he wrote the book.
Just as simply behind the scenes, you know, because fans are always want to know, like, what's it really like? You know, what they say, what's he like? And so just sort of do a behind the scenes diary. And I was influenced by that. David Halberstam, great American nonfiction writer of the 20th century, probably the best, wrote, you know, great books on Watergate. I mean, on the Vietnam War and, you know, a lot of issues of the day, Korean War, whatever, American government. And so he wrote a book. He was interested in a lot of sports, was a big sports fan. And he did a kind of an embedded with a Portland Trailblazers in the late 1970, a book called The Breaks of the Game. And it was a wonderful, you know, inside, behind the scenes look, character studies. And so I once thought if I ever wrote a book, that's the kind of book I'd like to write. And so I thought, well, yeah, I'll write that book on the Bulls this year, you know. And then so it was as simple as that. And but the other part was I knew I had an interesting story because of Jordan, but also because of his frustration growing toward trying to win a championship while all these young players are coming through and are, you know, being exposed to the hot poker of his, you know, temper and his personality, basically. So there was a lot of, you know, internal kind of issues, although I didn't really depict them as, you know, really too serious, because they were improving all along. There was an arc of success in some sense. They weren't ultimately winning, but each year they were going farther in the playoffs, doing better. So I didn't feel like it was hurting the team at all, you know, what Jordan's behavior. I didn't see it as this issue that it sort of not it came out to be, because it didn't affect the team, obviously. After the book came out, they were better than they were before the book came out. You know, they went and won 67 games and won the title again. But part of it was the marketing, because Jordan had been set up. In marketing, advertising is about selling you something you don't need. It's about depicting a product that may not be exactly what it is. And not to say Michael Jordan, you know, wasn't a decent guy or anything, but the advertising campaign, which was brilliant, associated him with all these sort of comfortable, homemade, what we call, you know, American brands, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Chevrolet, so-called all-American kind of stuff. And, you know, Michael, nice looking guy, great smile, you know, doing TV appearances on, you know, some of the bigger, you know, shows, David Letterman or Saturday Night Live. And so he's the, you know, the marketing plan was this, you know, ideal guy next door, sort of every mother's son. And then, and you know, and then the reality of it is, yeah, he's not a criminal. He's not a bad, evil person, but he can be, you know, really nasty sometimes. But, you know, in his view, a necessity toward dragging these young players, you know, Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen, when it came to the NBA in 87, 88, you know, their reserves, they're two young kids from rural southern towns, never been in the big city, and all of a sudden they got money and they're out just having fun. And Michael Jordan's, you know, he's done that. You know, I'm about being serious here. And he's trying to, you know, herd these cats along in the same direction towards success. And these kids want to run around, have fun, you know, and the team keeps adding young players. And, you know, so I think a lot of what came out was interpreted as, you know, Jordan being a jerk or mean-spirited. It's interesting. And that was the controversy about the book at the time, essentially. And I remember, you know, some of his coaches, Roy Williams, was on TV saying, oh, this is all a lie, and this is not Michael Jordan, you know, sort of the, not that it mattered, you know, I've been fine, but, you know, it's like 30 years later, Jordan finally copped to it and said, well, yeah, that's the way I was. So what? You know, it worked. Who cares?
Is there a bit of satisfaction for the journalist in you when you saw Jordan admit that on The Last Dance?
Well, internally a little bit, but, you know, I knew, you know, because, you know, the people you should trust, I don't have to tell you, are journalists more than anybody. You know, we're the only people who, if we tell a lie, lose our jobs and never get to work again. You know, if you make something up in journalism, in real journalism, not, you know, writing a blog out of your basement or something, but if you work for an organization and they catch you in a lie once, not only do they fire you, but nobody else will ever hire you. So, you know, I understand that people's view of journalism, you know, is backward. You know, the people you don't trust are the people you elect, people you buy products from. You know, they're trying to sell you something. We're not. You know, we're trying to deliver you. We don't know the whole story all the time, but what we're trying to deliver you is close to what happened. So I was comfortable that the story was, you know, was true. You know, whatever people's view of it was, I can't control that all the time. But at the same time, I was staying around and, you know, I was continuing to work in the NBA and cover the Bulls and cover the NBA. But, maybe I just had a suppressed laugh that, you know, it took 30 years for Jordan to finally circle around and say, okay, all right, I was a jerk, but who cares? And it sort of shows, you know, how comfortable he obviously is and who he is.
Just to put some context on it for the people who aren't aware, there was a number of revelations about Jordan in the book. Now, I'd say it was perfectly even-handed. I mean, there was plenty. He was portrayed in a good light, and he did some very kind things as well. But the kind of the main headlines were that he had punched Will Perdue at a training session. There was another where he told Pippen and another player, Vincent, not to pass the ball to poor clumsy Bill Cartwright or else I'll never pass you the ball again. So all this came out. And then there was a heck of a reaction, Sam, and I know the documentary touched on it a little bit, whereas you were told not to go into work for a week. And am I right to say that one of the wire services reported you missing for a little while?
Yeah, no, you're right. See, when I wrote it, you know, like I said, it was innocent. And the other thing I didn't mention was I couldn't even sell it, you know, because the notion was, well, this is a losing team. And who are you? You know, some newspaper writer in Chicago. So there wasn't any great demand for the book either at the time, you know, or the manuscript or the idea, really. And you're right. I see, when I wrote it, I thought it was even handed. I said, well, yeah, I pointed out some things where Jordan was, you know, difficult. But then I pointed out a number of things because I basically liked the guy. So I pointed out a number of things where, you know, he was, you know, nice to kids. The terminally ill kids would come around. He greeted everyone and, you know, whatever he did, show and hurts. But, you know how sometimes things are out of context. That That's stuff that the subjects complain about a lot of time that journalists do. They took what they said out of context. And so there was a lot of that. If you point out seven negative things and you don't point out any positive things, it sounds like a negative approach. So yeah, so because what happened at the time, the Bulls had just won their first title, and so Chicago doesn't have a history of winning teams. You know, the Chicago baseball Cubs famously hadn't won in over 100 years, and you know, Chicago viewed as a sort of this second city of loser kind of thing. And so now they finally have a team that wins. And I wrote this book, and the book gets released, and the narrative becomes now the Bulls are going to be destroyed because I've revealed all this internal fighting, and it's going to tear apart the team, and they'll never win again. And so, the community was outraged. You know, Jordan's defenders nationally were outraged. And, you know, this was not a social media era, so there wasn't the Twitter, Facebook, whatever, all that sort of stuff, whatever that stuff, all the accusatory stuff that goes on. But it still, you know, there still was media. And so I was getting threats. And so the newspaper, the Chicago Tribune then, and they said, why don't you take a week. And there still were radio and TV stations. And so I'm getting called for interviews and whatever. And, you know, there was no cell phones. So the phone is ringing all the time. And they said, well, just take your phone off the hook and just stay home, you know, for a week. And so I didn't answer the phone. And my family lived out in the East Coast still in New Jersey. And the AP published an item or a little short story saying that Arthur was missing because nobody could find me because I wasn't answering the phone. And I was just kind of, I had my son was like two then. I would just take him out to the mall, walk around, just stay away from, you know, and even then I'd pass people walking around saying, ah, that's Sam Smith, that's so-and-so. And so my mother ends up calling me. Finally, I answered the phone later and wanted to know where I was. She said she had read I was missing. So I said, no, I'm still here. And the Bulls were on a road trip then. So actually what I did, because I'd had this experience being an investigative reporter, my first editor who started the investigative journalism in Indiana, he had made this a policy, which I've always followed, which I thought is the right way to exhibit yourself if you do a strong story. In effect, symbolically, but physically, you got to stand behind your story. So he always made me, when I wrote a tough story, the day it appeared in the newspaper, to go and see that person, whether it was in the cases with him, it'd be a mayor or city official or something. But go see them and tell them if they got any questions, any problems, you're there. And I did that with Jordan when they came back from the road trip. And that first road trip when the book came out, I went up to Jordan at his locker. And I said, just let you know, I'm going to be here covering the team. If you got any problems or issues with me, just let me know. And he never said anything. And to this day, has never said a word to me about the book or anything related to it.
We're going to stay in America now, because as the country roiled in protest following the murder of George Floyd, we spoke with ESPN writer Howard Bryant, who is an outstanding writer on racial issues in the United States and its intersection with sport. In his book, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field, Howard identified and explained many of the American problems that were then made so horribly obvious to the rest of the world during the protests. One of those is the militarization of the police, something Howard links back to sport. When he writes in the book, with its thirst to concoct heroes, sport has been the military's most reliable corporate ally in anesthetizing the public. So I began by asking him to expand on that line.
It's relevant to what's happening today, where you see so many calls. There's this slowly nervous, anxious moment about defunding the police and about abolishing police and about this. And when you're looking at all the news and what's happening in the United States, the military and the police looking almost identical and seeing police wearing camouflage. And it's like, that's not camouflage. Why are you wearing desert camo in the middle of New York City? And so the certain level of imagery of a militarized police, all of this goes back to 9/11. And what we're talking about here when people talk about defunding the police, what you're really saying is is what has happened to us. And post 9/11, the embedding of the military into police in terms of the 1033 program, where you have the police receiving all of this military-grade equipment in terms of, you know, why do you need an MRAP in an American city? Do we need mine-resistant vehicles in the middle of Philadelphia? It's not necessary. But when you look at what has happened to the police force over the last 20 years, it has become more and more and more militarized. And then when you look at what this, the role of sports in that has done for the public, when you watch a sporting event now, it looks like a military rally. You've got the gigantic American flag across the football field. You've got the military induction services. You've got the cops singing the national anthem. It is constantly militarized. You've got the veterans from the different wars that are trotted out. You've got all of these different elements that are geared toward recruitment, and they're in your sports. And this is also happening at a time when you have American fans saying, we don't want politics in our sports. Well, what is more political than war? What is more political than having the military in the middle of a basketball game be part of this? And you see, you watch a baseball game, and the players are wearing uniforms that are camouflage, camo jerseys now. So the military has recognized all of this. They've recognized sports as a wonderful vehicle for them to recruit. They realize that in terms of the eyeballs, you've got hundreds of millions of people watching the same event. So they've essentially embedded themselves into this, into the business of sports, into how sports are viewed and how sports are sold to the public. And then on top of that, it's not even organic. These were military contracts with sports leagues. So the public was being deceived. The public had believed that post 9/11, that this was part of the patriotic war effort of sports teams sort of organically doing their part to support the troops. But instead, the sports leagues, the military was paying these sports leagues to have a presence in sporting events. And that, to me, was deceptive. And it absolutely used sports as a way to continue recruiting and to essentially sell war to the American public.
Was there much of a public debate about the militarization of sport post 9/11?
No debate whatsoever. And that's been one of the amazing things about this moment right now. Now you're starting to see talks about defunding and demilitarizing the police, and you're seeing all of that. But in terms of sports, people allowed it to happen because when you have an all-volunteer military, you essentially take the position that they're doing the fighting for us and that you have to thank them because they're doing something you don't want to do. And so very few people, as the wars have continued to escalate, very few people have come out and said anything because, other than thank you, they're not questioning any of this. They're not questioning the fact that we've been fighting war for 20 consecutive years, which is the longest stretch of war in this country's history. And it's become normalized. It's part of the country. It's part of the culture right now. And now I think you're starting to see a little bit of a step back, and you're looking and you're going, is this necessary? And especially a few years ago when you had the two Republican senators, John McCain and Jeff Flake, expose the sports leagues for doing this for money. I think that helped a little bit, but it didn't change the culture. So now when you watch a sporting event, military and police are absolutely part of the game day experience. But I think that what's happening both with COVID and with all of these protests right now, I really do think that we're starting to reach the end of the 9/11 era of sports.
It's also a difficult debate to have, I guess, Howard, in the sense like if you're critical of the military's presence, it can be misconstrued as you're being critical of the troops. Like, these people are brave. How dare you?
Not possible. It happens all the time. It's a great way that the military and that fans, in a lot of ways, they use the troops as shields. And to which one of the great ways to be supportive of military and of troops is to not put them in harm's way, is for them not to be in places where they shouldn't be. And yet, I think that people, because they're not doing the fighting, and I think because they really don't pay nearly as much attention as they need to, I think they've sort of recognized as well that the best way to act like you're part of the war effort is to put a sticker or put a magnet on your car and to say thank you all the time and to question nothing.
This might be too mad a take, but in terms of how we talk about sports and how we write about it, we use quite a militaristic vocabulary in terms of battles and wars and soldiers and troops and in the trenches and so on. Is that something that you've noticed creeping in more and more in the last few years? Or
well, it's been there for a long time, especially in football. No, and you hear these guys. I go to war with these guys every day. No, you don't. You do not war with these guys every day. You guys play sport, and everyone's going to be okay at the end of it. But we understand the metaphors. And the metaphors are actually more and more dangerous now because there is a military presence in football, especially, and in sports. So when you're fighting 20 years worth of war, and when you're seeing sort of the destruction that we're seeing right now, then those phrases sort of take on a bit of a grotesque sort of flavor to them. They feel inappropriate. And also knowing full well, as we know, that the military after Vietnam, for the most part, have crafted a vision of war that you don't see, that's not really war. You know, they've crafted this sort of idea of a bloodless war. We don't see any coffins anymore coming off the planes. We don't see any casualties. We don't see any visions of combat. So it's almost as if we can go on with our lives and they can just keep fighting perpetual war because there's no cost. We don't see the cost. And I think that's only going to increase the more of a technological war you fight, the more drones you send out, the more technology you use. So you can continuously wage war and it looks like nobody's being hurt.
We mentioned Colin Kaepernick. I think the militarization of sports was one of the ways in which it was used anyway to discredit Kaepernick. So when he took a knee, he was accused by Trump and other people of disrespecting the flag and disrespecting the military. Kaepernick, I think it's fair to say, has improved entirely right about what he was protesting. 4 years ago, three and a half years ago, he was taking a knee, and now people across the world are taking a knee in protest at exactly that issue. How is Kaepernick going to be remembered? Is he going to be remembered as one of the most important athletes of his generation?
Yes, he is, and I'm starting to refer to him as Obi-Wan Kenobi from now on. Because it has happened this way. And the NFL tried to silence him in 2017. They tried to demonize him in 2016. And yet here we are 4 years later still talking about him. He's like Obi-Wan. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. And here you are looking at people around the world taking a knee the same way he did. And it's a very powerful thing in a lot of ways. And I remember obviously being here and covering the story for so long, the number of times you heard people say, oh, well, he's irrelevant. Clearly, he is not irrelevant. Clearly, his name still comes up. And the NFL, in a lot of ways, by trying to destroy him, made him that sort of legendary figure that this generation and future generations are going to remember.
Now, last month, we did an epic two-part record with the Sunday Times chief sports writer David Walsh. We obviously covered a pretty wide range of topics, but there was one topic our WhatsApp members wanted to hear about more than any other, his relationship with Paul Kimmage. Paul went on News Talk 4 years ago and said that the relationship between you guys was dead and it was finished over. He took objection at your coverage of Team Sky. Is the relationship dead?
No, it's not dead. No. I mean, or if could I quote Mark Twain?
Yes.
Reports of the death of our relationship have been greatly exaggerated.
Oh, very good.
No. We talk. I've seen Paul a number of times over the last, maybe when I say number of times, three or four times over the last couple of years. We've spent time in each other's company. I mean, I live in England. He lives in Dublin, so it's not easy. We speak on the phone pretty regularly. I would, you know, it would be amazing if, you know, if I didn't speak to him, so I say, every couple of weeks. Now, there would have been a time when we would have spoken, you know, twice every day. So
yeah.
It's not quite where it was, but I think it's pretty good. I would still regard him as a close friend. And I always regarded him as a close friend, even when Paul didn't feel that he wanted to be, that he didn't want our relationship to endure. But I think Paul, I hope he wouldn't mind me saying it, there are times when he gets very angry and very annoyed at something. And I used to say to him during those times, you know, when we would talk about stuff like that, I'd say, you're never at your most rational when you're at your most angry. They don't go hand in hand. And I think Paul would probably admit that. I don't know if he would, but I think it's true. And I have got many, many faults and many things that are not great about me. And, I, you know, he'd be certainly entitled to say that. But my argument always was to him, there's too much shared history between us for us not to talk to each other. That would be ridiculous. I mean, we go back to Ross Taunton, 1980 or 1981, when Paul, whenever Paul met Anne, his wife. I mean, I knew Anne before Paul knew her. And we kind of got to know each other. He got to know Anne partly as a result of kind of I taking Anne and the Ross Taunton. And she came in the car because her brother was riding in the race, Paul Nolan. And she came, she wanted to lift. Her dad asked me, would I take her? And I did. And I think it was that Sunday that Anne met Paul in the Phoenix Park at the end of the Ross Taunton. And, you know, the amount of times we've spent together. I mean, Molly, our youngest daughter, was talking yesterday about being on the beach in Portugal, and the Kimmages and the Welches were there together. And our kids played with their kids when they went out to the nightclub at night. You know, Owen and Evelyn and Luke went out with Molly and Emily and Connor, whoever was around, and they all went out together. We spent, you know, endless days on that beach at Valdelobo together. So, you know, how can you just say all of that didn't happen? Mm. I couldn't, and I don't think Paul can either, because you know, he picks up the phone when I answer, and we have good chats.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear it. Next time you're telling him, or you're talking to him, do tell him to come on this show. We've been asking a couple of times, but
yes, yeah.
We'll get him eventually. On the Team Sky stuff, I mean, you got a bit of criticism for it. I think it's fair to say Paul vocalized it. I'll give the context for listeners in case you don't know. So, you did a book with Team Sky. You spent 13 weeks within the camp, and Paul took objection to a piece that you wrote in the Sunday Times, and then with the book itself, it emerged in the press that Bradley Wiggins had been given 3 TUEs. It didn't break the rules, but as a parliamentary select committee found, they did cross an ethical line, mainly because these were pretty powerful TUEs and they were administered just weeks before a couple of the Tour de France and I think a Giro d'Italia as well. And Paul, like, specifically said, in terms of the specific criticisms of you, just to contextualize that for listeners, the fact that you failed to disclose the fact that Paul was also given the same access and then it was reneged upon at the last minute, and then you quoted Bradley Wiggins, or sorry, told a story of Bradley Wiggins telling someone around him to snap off a Livestrong band because, you know, Lance Armstrong is persona non grata here, whereas in Wiggins he'd put in his book that he admired Armstrong in various ways. So, like, how do you look back at it now? Was the criticism difficult? Was it fair? How do you reflect on it?
I think it was fair. I had no difficulty with it. Now, it should be said, you make the point about that the Bradley Wiggins' TUEs, which was cheating, absolutely, no question. That emerged in September 2016. Mm. I had spent time inside Team Sky in 2013. So there's a 3-year gap. It's always, now, you could say you went embedded, but you never found out about the TUEs. That's absolutely true. I didn't. And what you learn from being embedded is that the fact that you're embedded doesn't guarantee that you're going to be told everything. And you don't really have the right to break into the doctor's room and maybe open up files and photograph them or steal stuff. I mean, I wasn't going to do that. I thought at the time I was seduced, really, by Brailsford with the offer of being inside the team. Being inside the team was a really interesting experience, but unfulfilling journalistically. Now, when I say that, I say it kind of, you know, reservedly, because when I was inside the team, I made contacts. And when stories broke later, I was in a better position to write them than most people because I knew lots of people in the team. I mean, they had a rider who tested positive, and in 2015 or 2014 World Championships, Sunday Times were the newspaper that broke the story. Like, we broke that this guy was positive. Now, it turned out that he'd actually been positive from his previous team, but it was when he joined Sky that the results came out. And if I were to go back and had the chance to make a new decision, I wouldn't go in Team Sky. It was Frankie Andreo said something to me that I disagreed vehemently with him at the time. Frankie said, look, stay on the outside and stay neutral. And I said, Frankie, but if I believe Team Sky are clean, and I deliberately stop myself saying that, is that not a lie? But my mistake really was to presume that they would never have done what they did in relation to those Wigan's TUEs. I didn't think that was part of what Brailsford would do. And I kind of jumped to the conclusion that he had more integrity than he had. I think that was a shocking decision to give Wiggins those TUEs. Richard Freeman, the doctor, is still before the General Medical Council in the UK. His case is coming up in the autumn. And hopefully, you know, that will be resolved, that case. And I think it completely, not tarnishes, but it kind of takes all the credibility from Wiggins' Tour de France victory. I don't regard him as a legitimate winner of the Tour. I think at the very least there should be an asterisk there highlighting the fact that he used TUEs that, in my opinion, he never needed. Now, when the story broke, I was in a position to write well about it because I had real insight into the team. I totally believe that Brailsford should have been sacked, or he should have resigned once it came out. That didn't happen. And it meant that I was never going to speak to Brailsford again, and not in any kind of affable way, that's for sure. And I haven't spoken to him since. And I go on the Tour de France and I try to do my job. Part of that job should be listening to, I mean, if this is a press conference, I will go in and listen. But I don't want to interact with him because ultimately he said to me, look, we do things correctly. You can come inside our team and you can look wherever you like and you will see that we're doing nothing untoward. And you might say naively, I believe that. And I went in and of course I didn't know anything about these TUEs. I mean, the third TUE happened at a time when I was inside the team. But the doctors who were doing it, some of whom I was quite good friends with, they were never going to tell me, we've just given Brad a new TUE. I mean, Richard Freeman, I interviewed him, and he was quite bland, and I interviewed him during that tour of Italy. And he said to me, I don't trust anybody in this sport. Now, the reality was that he was about the least trustworthy of any doctor in the Tour de France because he was the one who organized these TUEs for Bradley Wiggins. And he's the one who's now, you know, facing charges from the General Medical Council of having ordered testosterone patches. Now, this is going to sound like I'm trying to kind of justify my existence. Richard Freeman is before the Medical Council because he ordered testosterone patches that were delivered to Team Sky in the headquarters of British Cycling. That story appeared for the first time in the Sunday Times, and I wrote it. Mm. So I can't deny, you know, that even though it might have been the wrong decision, journalistically I got a lot out of it. And whether I like it or not, that's the truth. I don't mind saying it was a bad decision on my behalf. The Armstrong thing had just happened. Maybe there was a bit of, you know, that very dangerous feeling of, you know, that you can almost do anything and it'll be right because you're on a bit of a crest of a wave. Maybe I was influenced by that. I would think possibly, you know, if somebody said, I think you got carried away, I'd say, I didn't feel like I got carried away, but maybe I did. So, yeah. You know, I mean, and as I say, if you gave me the chance to do it again, I certainly would say, no, Dave, I'm staying on the outside, safer place.
Yeah, so I was going to ask how or if it has changed you, but obviously that's how. You're not going to accept an invite into the tent.
No, because I would say to any journalist, be careful being embedded. You know, but maybe I should have known that, because if you'd said to me, what do you think about those look, like foreign correspondents who go, war correspondents who go embedded with the US Army when they're invading Iraq. I say, well, they're only going to be shown what the US Army wants them to see. So journalistically, it's pretty hopeless. And somebody then might have said to me, but you went into Team Sky and they were only going to show you what they wanted you to see. And I would have then been stuck for an answer. But you know, and that is the limitation of being embedded. The people who are inviting you in are inviting you in on their terms.
One of this show's biggest failings thus far has been the gender balance among our guests. Of our 35 guests, only 5 of them have been women. Now, that is partly a reflection of the industry, but it's also something we can do a lot better at and we're working on. Because regardless of how gendered things are now, it's nothing like it was back in the 1970s. As US sports writer Diane K. Shaw explained to us in episode 39. There's a very strange interview with Mickey Mantle. Would you mind telling us that story?
Growing up, I was a big Yankee fan. I was a Mickey Mantle fan. I grew up in Chicago, but my dad was from New York. So he loved the Yankees, and I picked it up from him. He loved Joe DiMaggio. I loved his successor, Mickey Mantle. And when I got this job at the National Observer and they let me do what I want, Mickey Mantle had retired, but he had just been brought back as the Yankees' first base coach. Ah, I said to my editor, this is an important story. You better send me. So off I go, and I'm really, really nervous. This was my childhood hero, and I was going to get to meet him. So the Yankees let me down on the field, and I'm standing by the dugout waiting for Mantle to come out. This was during batting practice. And one of the players said, you know, who are you waiting for? And I said, Mantle. And he goes, oh, okay. And he goes and he gets Mantle. He waves. He asked me to come into the dugout. And I don't know if you've been in one, but you walk through the, it gets kind of like this dark hallway that leads from the dugout to the locker room. And so Mantle was there. And he says, oh, I forgot you was waiting for me. And he agreed to let me interview him after the game. And he was staying in New York at the St. Moritz Hotel. He said to meet him there at 6 or 6:30, I don't remember which. I said, okay. So I get to the hotel, and I call. And the operator said, he put me through to him. He was in the bar. He said, I'm in the bar. Meet me in the bar. I said, oh, okay. So I go into this, it's a big room, and he's sitting at a table, and he's got a drink in front of him, half a drink in front of him. I think he'd had several already, and I am so nervous. And I sit down, and back then, every interview I had ever heard someone do with Mantle, the first question was always the same, which was, hey, Mickey, how are your legs? Because he had bad legs. So that's what I said. Hi, Mickey. How are your legs? And he said, not so nice as yours. I thought, okay, bad question. So he's being very good at this interview, and he keeps calling for more drinks. And I don't know, hour and a half goes by, we're still talking. And I asked him, he had 4 sons, and I said, are they going to play baseball? And he said, well, maybe the oldest one. And I said, I don't know why. I said something about, well, how long have you been married? And he said, oh, too long. And he reaches into his inside jacket pocket and pulls out a greeting card, and he hands it to me. And I assumed, I don't know, it had flowers on the front. It looked like, I was thinking, maybe this is a card he's sending his wife. I opened it up, and it said, let's have sex, but he used a different word. Mm. And I didn't know what to do. I just handed the card back. And right then, 2 friends came in. We ended up all going to dinner. Mantle kept drinking, and the final part of the story, we walked out of the restaurant. We were getting ready to cross a street, and he slipped on the curb and fell. And as I wrote, for one split second, my hero was lying in the gutter. And he jumped to his feet and he said, "New shoes." And that was my Mickey Mantle story. It taught me one important lesson: never interview or get to know your heroes.
Yeah, but when you were given that card, I'm kind of surprised you didn't walk out and leave. Did you feel you couldn't?
I think in many ways, I really always had blinders on, and I think it helped me with a lot of this stuff, especially some of the things being the first. I had two goals. One, let me in the locker room and answer my questions. I have a story to write. I'm on deadline. I thought it made Mantle look bad. I wasn't going to leave. I had a story to write, and I didn't feel threatened at that point. I let it go. I let a lot of things go. The only thing I cared about is just don't get in my way. If you get in my way or threaten me physically, that's a different story. Otherwise, I just tried to do the job.
Did you regret letting a lot of these things go? Because there are a ton of, now they're not quite as ostentatious as what Mickey Mantle did, but there are plenty of these stories that you reference in the book, and I'm wondering, is there regret on your part that you let them go, or was that just the jeopardy of doing business, I guess?
No, to the contrary. My attitude was this. Okay, I come to L.A., I have this important job, and the Raiders, the Los Angeles Raiders football team, they won't let me in the locker room. I'm going to figure that out myself. I'm not going to go to my editor and dump a bunch of girl sports writer problems on his desk. I didn't believe in lawsuits. I got involved in one, but it was without my permission. I wanted to figure out how to solve the problem myself. And every time that I did, it was such a feeling of empowerment. And I think that's something that many people might think about today. If a guy looks at me funny or says something, so what? That doesn't threaten my job. You know, he's a jerk. Or, you know, there were some examples, a couple in the book, of me giving it back to them. It never really bothered me because it never threatened me physically or my job. So I felt good that I could solve my own problems. And I think it's something that maybe some people might try to do.
And that is it. Thank you so much for listening in and supporting the show. As I said, we'll be back to normal service from next week. But until then, take it easy.